This is JAMDA On The Go, your review of the content featured in JAMDA, the research-focused monthly journal of AMDA, the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care. This podcast is eligible for ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits. Details will be provided at the end of this podcast. And now, here is your host for JAMDA On The Go, Dr. Wayne Saltzman.
Welcome to JAMDA On The Go. This podcast will spotlight articles from the September 2020 issue of JAMDA, the Journal of the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. Again, we'll be speaking with JAMDA co-editor-in-chief, Dr. Philip Sloan, and associate editor, Dr. Mallory Brown. Dr. Sloan is a family physician and geriatrician with a master's degree in public health. He is the Elizabeth and Oscar Goodwin Distinguished Professor of Family Medicine and Geriatrics at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and co-director for the Program on Aging, Disability, and Long-Term Care at the Cecil G. Shepp Center for Health Services Research. Dr. Brown is also a family physician and geriatrician at the University of North Carolina, where she is an associate professor of family medicine and director of the residency training program. Today's topics include antibiotic use, misuse, and tracking, the role of leadership in promoting certified nursing assistant retention, and a recent JAMDA report indicating that pregnancy history increases frailty risk in later life. Doctors Brown and Sloan, welcome back to JAMDA On The Go.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Thanks, Wayne.
So once again, we have a wonderful month of articles in JAMDA for September. I'd like to kind of get right on it. For this first part, Dr. Sloan, we'll be discussing two papers. Both papers are about infections, and amazingly, neither one mentions COVID-19. Is that, am I heading in the right direction there, Dr. Sloan?
Yes, in fact, none of the articles we're talking about today are going to talk about COVID.
Oh. Wonderful. Yeah. It's nice to be able to try to focus on some other aspects of care that are very important. So the first article is actually co-written by you. Preventative antibiotic use in nursing homes, a not uncommon reason for antibiotic overprescribing. So what is this all about? Especially with regard to non-COVID issues?
Well, you know, there's a lot of work to be done that is not just COVID work, as everybody who's in the field knows. This particular article began with conversations I had with a postdoc in our program, Dr. Mira Tandon. I was wondering how it could be, you know, some experts claim that as many as 75% of antibiotics prescribed in nursing homes could be unnecessary.
Right.
It seemed like a ridiculous number, and you know, I was asking about it, and Dr. Tandon, who's a health services researcher who focuses on antibiotic stewardship, she was speculating that perhaps a lot of prescriptions that don't meet guidelines can be thought of as preventative. So we kind of followed that along. For example, you know, maybe a quarter of antibiotics for urinary tract disease are ongoing prescriptions for prophylaxis because of recurrent UTIs. It's a common practice among urologists, you know, nitrofurantoin once a day for 6 months, that kind of thing.
Yeah. I can tell you that some of my most difficult conversations with both patients, residents, and family caregivers and nursing staff has been around the long-term antibiotics and how they're working, and especially with regard to folks who may have indwelling bladder catheters and have been on suppressive antibiotics, and yet you see the family see dark urine or sediment, and it must be an infection, and what else can possibly happen because they're on suppressive antibiotics? It can be a significant time sink and a significant problem.
Yeah, it's such a can of worms. You know, there's a lot of magical thinking among the general public about antibiotics, and it's beginning to erode some, which is nice. But in the past, it was just okay to use antibiotics for prevention, you know. And, you know, for example, in the emergency department, you stitch up a wound, no matter how clean it was and how small it was, and you'd give them, you know, 3 days of Keflex. And the surgeon, of course, used antibiotics prophylactically all the time for any kind of major surgery. And the public's used to it. You know, a mosquito bite, you know, a physical therapist told me, well, just make sure you put a triple antibiotic on it for a few days. And it's kind of like, you know, waving a magic wand. So when we started looking at nursing home practice, you know, we made a list of situations where antibiotic prescription can be thought of as preventative. And in addition to recurrent UTIs, the list includes treating acute sinusitis to prevent bacterial superinfection, ongoing antibiotic treatment of people with COPD to prevent exacerbations or reduce hospitalizations, topical or systemic antimicrobials to prevent skin infection in persons with swollen legs and recurrent cellulitis. You know, all these things have some database, some evidence base behind them. You know, antibiotic treatment at the time of dental work, you know, yes, to prevent endocarditis in patients with history of cardiac disease or to prevent bacterial infection of an artificial joint. These are all things that have got some body of evidence, not necessarily from nursing homes. And with the high prevalence of antibiotic resistance in nursing homes, and it just gets to be a little trickier. So I can't go into all of this, but a few take homes from that article are the following. First, regarding antibiotics for recurrent UTIs, studies do show that prophylaxis will prevent about 50% of recurrences. But given the serious risk of producing resistant organisms and the clear evidence that bacterial colonization doesn't increase morbidity or mortality, and it's often overtreated, I think we can make a strong case for minimizing this practice and using non-antibiotic options such as intravaginal estrogens, which, by the way, have the same effectiveness rate as antibiotics, and then cranberry capsules, which aren't quite as good. Secondly, you know, regarding viral bronchitis, research shows, interestingly, that if you give 40 courses of antibiotics to people with viral bronchitis, you'll prevent one pneumonia.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's better to monitor patients with bronchitis for a secondary pneumonia rather than to foster antibiotic resistance by treating prophylactically. And the third point from this I thought would be particularly useful to make is about dental work, because, you know, the field has changed, you know, for those of us who've been around for a while, we used to give it to anything. If your patient is about to have dental work, check carefully for current recommendations before agreeing to prescribe a periprocedural antibiotic. In the past, almost any heart condition was considered a reason for antibiotics. Now, very few are. The same is true regarding dental work for persons with artificial joints. So to summarize, and the trend is, as we all know, for fewer antibiotics, which means prophylaxis is less regarded as a routine, but instead as an exception. Tough stuff.
You know, I just have to say that this whole issue around antibiotic use is like a battleship. It takes 3 miles to make a turn, but it's articles like this in a journal like JAMDA which really do help make that turn. So thank you for that. The next paper is challenges in tracking and reporting antibiotic use in long-term care, and this paper is authored by two individuals who have contributed to the society for a long period of time and are both committed and invested in antibiotic stewardship. Can you tell us a little bit more about this paper?
Sure thing. It continues the theme of there's no easy answer when it comes to infection. Edward Davidson, a clinical pharmacist, and Robin Jump, one of AMDA's leading infectious disease experts, wrote this paper really to talk about how should your facility record and track infections as part of its antibiotic stewardship program. In the past, most nursing homes took the easy route and merely had their infection control nurse go through the MAR and list every antibiotic prescription. The assumption was that an antibiotic prescription equaled an infection, and if there wasn't a prescription, then it wasn't an infection. Now, we, of course, know that that's not right because viral infections are infections, and you don't give antibiotics for them. But that worked fine, you know, as long as it was just to check a box, you know, for CMS. But now CMS wants each nursing home to have a system to monitor antibiotic use, which means coming up with a more sophisticated arrangement. And that's what this article is about. The paper discusses four different metrics that can be used in long-term care settings, but frankly, two of them really aren't very practical, so I'll talk about the two that are. First is days of antibiotic therapy per 1,000 days of care. This is, you know, what the hospitals have been using for years. It's the most common metric. It has an advantage over counting prescriptions because it takes into account not just the number of prescriptions, but how long they, what their duration is. And as we know, shortening the duration of prescriptions is one of the low-hanging fruit for antibiotic stewardship. So this measure should be easy to get done electronically. Many systems are doing it already. It does require some programming expertise. So it's just really becoming the standard for facilities to generate these reports. And so if your nursing home isn't doing it, it's worth taking a look at this paper and talking to your administrator and seeing if they can find somebody who can help make it happen. And certainly the chains are doing a good job with it. So this is really becoming a standard of care. The other measure to think about is antibiotic starts. And this is particularly useful for medical directors in large facilities with a number of providers. So basically, if you're a medical director, you've heard from the staff and so-and-so writes a lot of prescriptions and you don't know how to get a handle on it. By looking at antibiotic starts and what the prescription is for, you can generate statistics that will show the prescription rates of different providers, and then you put it into a report, and they've shown an example of a report in this article. You send the report to every doctor with their statistics and then the aggregate statistics for everybody else. You don't show anybody else's statistics individually, but just them versus the aggregate. And then you're ready to start a conversation. Now, the other thing about the paper is it does go into how to find data. And one key point it makes is that we often don't think of the dispensing pharmacy as a resource, or even the pharmacy consultant as a resource for antibiotic stewardship, but they can really help. And if the pharmacy fills all the prescriptions for its residents, it really, as with any administrative data, can generate, with the right programming, all the statistics that are needed.
Right.
In fact, that's probably a better source than the electronic medical record, because most nursing home medical records are just not that sophisticated. But if the MAR is there and you've got good data, hopefully developing a system to process and analyze the data will be feasible. And then you really have something in operation that will make antibiotic stewardship easier and more of a routine thing. So in this manner, antibiotic stewardship becomes a database quality improvement activity, and the needed statistics are calculated routinely for review by the Infection Control and Antibiotic Stewardship Committee. And this paper helps identify just how to do it.
You know, and I definitely have to give a shout out to the authors. Ed Davidson has been promoting for years the utility of the consultant pharmacist and how we can become more structured in looking at medicines and understanding total medication thoughts and uses. And so I definitely would recommend folks take a look at this paper. It's written by two wonderful authors.
Managing your patient's needs across multiple specialties is increasingly important, but also an increasingly challenging task. U.S. Post-Acute Care now offers clinical staffing solutions not only for primary care medicine, but also for behavioral health, chronic care management, and telehealth, bringing you a more comprehensive solution for your patients and your facilities. Now more than ever, your patients need you in so many ways. Let U.S. Post-Acute Care help you deliver more complete, quality care. For more information, visit us at uspostacutecare.com.
The next paper is on leadership, staff empowerment, and the retention of nursing assistants, findings from a survey of United States nursing homes. Dr. Brown, this is a paper that really talks about, it takes a village, and our certified nursing assistants are really such a valued asset. Can you tell us a little bit more about this paper?
Absolutely. I think, you know, there's a lot of things in this article that are intuitive, but it does a really nice job of digging in deeper and figuring out what it is that keeps our staff, particularly our nursing assistants, engaged and part of the practice. So we know that nursing home workforce instability, particularly for nursing assistants, is a significant and a costly problem. The bottom line is that it costs a lot to retrain and rehire folks. Right. We also know that high staff turnover is just not good for our patients' care. Many prior studies have looked at what leads to improved retention. Work environment, job satisfaction, and supervision have all been tied to retention. And more recently, leadership's ability to innovate around workforce redesign, to focus on person-centered care through enhancement and engagement of the staff, has also been noted as a factor in overall satisfaction and retention. The group that completed this study hypothesized that after adjusting for nursing home characteristics generally associated with staff stability, nursing homes have higher levels of leadership and staff empowerment practices, would have greater nursing assistant retention than facilities with lower levels of practices. Hmm. Seems like a reasonable hypothesis.
Absolutely.
The cross-sectional study examined the relationship between nursing assistant retention and a measure capturing nursing home leadership and staff empowerment. They looked at the data from the Nursing Home Culture Change Survey that was done in 2016 and 2017, with nursing home administrator respondents, and merged this with facility level indicators. They looked at four categories of one-year nursing assistant retention, identified as 0 to 50%, 51 to 75%, 76 to 90%, and then that highest tier of 91 to 100%. So I'll start by noting that occupancy rate, chain status, certified nursing assistant hours per day per resident, nursing home administrative turnover, and the presence of a union were all significantly associated with higher categories of retention, so in that 76 to 90% or 91 to 100% range. But the crux of this article really looks at workforce buy-in, essentially. So much more interestingly to me, and perhaps more importantly too, after adjusting for covariates, the leadership and staff empowerment score was the factor that most significantly was associated with nursing assistant retention, which is consistent with prior work that found a combination of managerial style, organizational culture, and staff empowerment practices to be associated with staff stability. Hmm. Including our nursing assistants in team membership and involvement in decision-making allows these valuable team members to feel supported and valued, and therefore improves retention in an individual organization. There are many fairly straightforward ways of doing just that, whether it's involvement in quality improvement teams, increased involvement in resident care plan meetings, or providing rewards for extra training and education. These are just a few examples. At the end of the day, don't we all prefer to have a voice at the tables? I mean, it makes perfect sense. When we have a say and take a larger part in an organization, whether it's our church, a club, a sports team, or in this case, a job, isn't that when we feel a sense of belonging and therefore want to stick around and continue to be a part of it?
Absolutely.
All of that said, this transition from a top-down approach is certainly a shift from the status quo. And culture change adoption isn't easy and requires new learning and adaptive leadership. This study, to me, seemingly shows us that modifiable leadership and staff empowerment practices can be associated with higher nursing assistant retention, and therefore are worth considering and starting to implement into our nursing home facilities.
This paper is amazing, and it's going to resonate with a lot of our, as I like to call them, JoAMDAs in the trenches. We know that empowering our nursing staff and in our own facility, we made the nursing staff a key player, the certified nursing assistant, a key player in understanding skin integrity. And once that happened and they were welcomed to the table and their input was seen as being important, it changed the dialogue and it changed the atmosphere and culture of the facility. So this paper was not just an eye opener, but it definitely resonates.
Absolutely.
Our last paper, Number of Pregnancies and Trajectory of Frailty Index, English Longitudinal Study of Aging. So this is a paper that you take a second glance at and say, pregnancy in the journal? But it's not that it's necessarily a fun article by mentioning pregnancy. It's actually very serious and significant, but it reminded me of my wife's grandmother, may she rest, who would say, big family, big trouble. She had 10 children. She was pretty functional, but this study shows that there may be a connection between pregnancy and frailty. Dr. Brown, tell us about it.
Yeah, I was grateful that Dr. Sloan let me pick which articles I wanted to read. This one really drew me in. As the mother of two small children, I was really curious if this study would come out in favor of more or no more children in the future. It seems intuitive to me that women are frailer than men across populations and age groups. However, when we stop to examine this, even when considering environmental, lifestyle, psychological or evolutionary factors, the mechanisms are still just not fully understood. I hadn't really stopped to think about it before. Frailty, the geriatric syndrome characterized by the age-related decline in multiple body systems and decreased physiological reserve, predisposes individuals to multiple adverse health outcomes, such as the falls, disability, fractures, dementia, and death. It's a big deal. This study investigated whether pregnancy and motherhood may be the underlying cause for all of that. Using a prospective study with repeated measures over a little more than a decade, about 2,000 community-dwelling older women, ages 60 and up, were monitored for their trajectory on the frailty index over time, according to their number of pregnancies. Interesting. Their frailty index was recalculated every 2 years over the 14-year observation period. Adjusting for age, smoking, alcohol use, education, and wealth showed that frailty index increased over time for each of almost all of these women. Very interestingly, a higher number of pregnancies was in fact significantly associated with a higher frailty index at baseline and over time. During pregnancy, at least in the generation studied here, women tend to eat differently, gain weight, and exercise less, and can be affected physically and psychologically in various ways. I wouldn't say any of those things to a woman who might be pregnant currently, however. A higher number of pregnancies has been shown to be associated with increased adiposity, increased insulin resistance, decreased glucose tolerance, and elevated inflammation, and has been linked to an increased risk of diabetes and some types of cancers. Gestational diabetes, we know, hypertension of pregnancy, preeclampsia, and the psychological issues that might include postpartum depression can all increase the likelihood of similar comorbidities in older age.
Wow.
Women with multiple pregnancies may have larger families, which could cause accumulated stress of child rearing, economic costs, and role overload. I feel that some days and I only have two. So I think all of this takes into account the underlying potential stressors on a woman's health, and also the psychosocial issues that might also contribute to their overall health as they grow older. So this study, using a representative cohort of community-dwelling older women, showed that a higher number of pregnancies was significantly associated with a higher degree of frailty at baseline and the trajectory over time. More work in extrapolation to other populations should be done, certainly, but it's really interesting to consider that pregnancy and child rearing may explain some of those observed excess risk of frailty in women. Considering my one-year-old hasn't slept the night yet, this study adds an interesting layer of support that 2 is the perfect number for my family.
What a unique article, and I guess there is definitely some substance to my wife saying that these kids are going to be the end of me. So really, really enjoyed that. And this brings us to a close for this JAMDA On The Go podcast. Under the leadership of co-editors-in-chief Drs. Philip Sloan and Cheryl Zimmerman, and with the support of editors like Dr. Mallory Brown, the Journal of the American Medical Directors Association continues to be an impactful resource in post-acute and long-term care and beyond. Everyone, take a look at this September 2020 issue. It's really great. Dr. Sloan and Dr. Brown, thank you again for spending your time with JAMDA On The Go.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure.
My pleasure, yes.
References for this podcast can be found at www.jamda.com. Until next time, I'm Dr. Wayne Saltzman for JAMDA On The Go.
Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care. If you are a physician and interested in obtaining ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits for certification or recertification, go to our new learning management system at apex.paltc.org. Click on podcast and follow the link to this latest episode. Thank you.